So thank you everyone for coming tonight. Good evening and welcome to the September YAP event. So tonight we're here to dive into the world of risk culture. In a world where there are increasing uncertainties and complexity, a robust risk framework is crucial to the long-term prosperity of an organisation and ultimately us as an individual who take part in it. Tonight, we're fortunate to have an expert in the field of risk management come educate us on the topic of risk culture. Our speaker has 35 years of actuarial and risk management experience across multiple practice areas, including life insurance, wealth management, and superannuation. He has written numerous publications for the Institute covering board leadership, risk, and control. He is a member of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee, as well as running executive training programs from time to time. His past life includes being a partner at Ernst & Young, and he now runs his own boutique consulting firm, McGing Advisory and Actuarial, out of Melbourne since 2010. So with that vast amount of knowledge and experience he brings tonight, I'm sure we'll have a very insightful session. So without further ado, could you please give a warm welcome to Sean McGing?
Well, thank you, Simon. You can probably all hear me. It's a nice room, this. It's not too big, not too small. I really enjoy coming to these functions. I think the Young Actuaries Program is a fantastic idea, and it's lovely to see it supported. It's good to share time and ideas with your colleagues, and you should never feel intimidated about anything that you hear from up this side of the podium. Okay. So the context for tonight's discussion is risk culture, risk management. And you've taken a bit of a risk in coming. You could be bored to tears. Well, hopefully that'll be a reward tonight, because with every risk there comes an opportunity. There's always two sides. Now, before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge my co-researcher on the material you're going to see today. So Andrew Brown, he's actually a member of council. I don't know if any of you know him. He's a Melbourne-based actuary like myself, but he actually specialises in leadership training and really helping people be the best they can be as individuals and also in a corporate context. And he and I have really enjoyed working in the last few years in doing research around leadership and risk culture and risk management. So he rightfully deserves half the praise and half the blame for tonight as well. Now, okay. Right. Okay, you guys are on the right-hand side, and I'm in there on the left somewhere. So risk, youth, culture. What do you first think of? I started my actuarial studies in the late 70s, and most of you have started much, much more recent than that. Now, spot the difference. You know, at one level, there's really not much difference. One's black and white. We did have colour cameras, but didn't venture to this mob. They must have been just out of school or something. In some ways, nothing has changed, and in other ways, quite a lot has changed. Both then and now, youth was and is incredibly influenced by fashion of what we would now call pop culture. And the word culture will obviously be used a lot during this evening, but it has many interpretations, it has many angles. Everybody will define it in different ways. But it does all embrace behavior and how people act, and we'll delve into behind that. So what will we cover? Okay, good. It's the left, not the right. Okay. over the course of the next hour or so, we'll look at a case study on changing risk culture, the Vic Roads road toll over the last 40 years or so. It's an interesting story. We'll look then at the definitions of risk and enterprise risk management, get into the nitty-gritty there. We'll look at defined culture and risk culture, look at what's a mature risk culture. So over time, where do you get to if you've got it right as an organization? There's a bunch of case studies we'll consider. There's a few more in the papers behind this that I encourage you to go and have a read of if you're interested. And we'll also try and measure the level of cultural maturity in an organization. And really, all of this, you know, it's a bit of a journey. There'll be elements of it that you might find interesting. There'll be elements that might be a bit confusing or different. How many of you work in risk management, if any? Yeah, so a couple. Yeah, so that's what I'd expect in terms of people saying they're working in risk management. The answer is you're all working in risk management to a greater or lesser extent. And that's important to be aware of as you go through. Any of this stuff I'm going to show you today, I've only picked up in the last 4 or 5 years. And I've done some very interesting things in those 4 or 5 years. It's still not the main line of my business. But it's happened that way because I got interested through my school in risk management, and because I was an actuary, they made the assumption that, oh, actuaries know all about risk. And they're right in the sense that we know a lot about risk. We don't know everything about risk, but we do know a lot about risk, even if we don't think we do. And I've been on a journey, and I've written a paper back in 2012, if you're interested, to go back and see my journey through that learning about risk and implementing a risk management framework at a school. And I'm still on that committee, so they must still think I'm adding some value. But I went into that just with an open mind, and I took a risk of exposing myself as being stupid, not understanding what was going on. I didn't know anything about schools, other than I'd been through one a long, long time ago. But the process was very revealing, because I actually was able to help a lot of other people, and I also learned a lot from other people who had different risk perspectives and just different perspectives in general. So I would encourage you to always have that open mind around risk. Any of you are more than capable of working in risk management in a more formal role, and if the opportunity comes up, don't be afraid to take it. Don't hold back just because you think you can't. You'll learn on the way if you've got an open mind. And at the end of the day, you'll add to your capabilities. So we will measure cultural maturity and finish up with some conclusions and recommendations. Okay. Risk, young, culture. Both of these go on quite a bit. So something's changed, something's stay the same. Major youth risks these days are greatly related to alcohol and drugs. Drugs is probably stronger. So there's been a bit of a change in emphasis from 40 years ago to now. We've got ICE, a horrific, tragic set of circumstances that are encroaching on people's lives. On the other hand, on the cigarette side of things and smoking, attitudes have changed enormously. And that change in behavior is really at the heart of culture generally and what people do. Back in the 70s, smoking was a big risk, as people in life insurance companies know. I worked for one. In fact, it was very interesting because the company I worked for was Australian, or it was originally Eagle Star in Ireland in the 70s and early 80s. And it got bought by British American Tobacco. And I always remember there was this fantastic discussion around introducing non-smoker rates. And in the end, there was a certain amount of evidence there, and as actuaries we had access to better statistics than the general population. And in the end, we didn't introduce non-smoker rates and smoker rates. We had a standard rate, and then we had a special discount rate, which was for people who didn't smoke. Yeah, so we're recognizing the reality of the statistics, but the marketing and the way it was done was interesting. The difference between then and now in terms of smoking in Australia and Ireland where I was that it was socially acceptable at the time. You know, most of our parents smoked, particularly the men. It was, you know, quite gender imbalanced in that sense, which is good for the women in terms of life expectancy and health and all of that at the time. It's evened up a bit now with opportunity, etc. But it was socially acceptable. And you know, you wonder now, how could that be socially acceptable? That's if you don't smoke. Might have a few smokers in here. I think it's around 17% of the population now. But that comes through education. Those societal norms actually influence things. Culture, youth, fast cars. The shape of these cars hasn't changed much, has it? But I'm sure what's under the bonnet has. and the miles per gallon or the litres per kilometre has changed as well. One of the first things I learned in my life contingencies studies was that there was an accident hump for males in the early 20s. And it really stood out on the mortality curve. And it's not there now to the same extent. And that was caused by motor accidents. These days, there's an influence of suicide. In those days, there was suicide in there and it wasn't recognized as such all the time. But car accidents was a big contributor to male mortality. Looking back now, that's probably the first example, or the beginning of an example, which I've learned over the years, of risk management in action and a risk culture around life and death, really important elements. The Vic Roads example I'll go through in a minute will illustrate that change in culture over the last 40 years. But what I want to really bring out is that for such changes to occur, someone has to stand up and say that something's wrong or needs change. You know, there's a courage that's required. Changes in behavior don't just happen. The individuals concerned and others who lead need to make the change. And that's still the case. That's a fundamental human position. And it's still the case with any of the companies that you work for. The leaders at the top are the ones who have to decide on change and hopefully it's positive change and then make that happen and help people follow them. The other critical ingredients as well as the courage to lead are around understanding. So you need to understand what's going on, what's behind the data, in this case in road toll statistics, and you need to take the time to learn that. You also need to realize that your data is going to be limited most of the time. That's the real world. And if you go back and look at the smoking statistics, for instance, at what point is there sufficient evidence that the Surgeon General in the US can come out and say it's bad to smoke? And the pushing by the tobacco companies has almost been, well, it's not proven. You get the same information these days, and I don't know what's right or what's wrong, around emissions, electromagnetic radiation, around mobile phones or Wi-Fi or stuff like that. So if you read the risk literature around emerging risks, you will actually see there's quite a lot of studies now that warn you about being too close to Wi-Fi sources or being overuse of those things. But that hasn't come into the mainstream yet. You know, that's one of the one of the things in emerging risk that companies need to do, particularly insurance companies, because they're insuring these risks and public liability for schools or other places, safety of children, etc. You know, it's one of the topics that's come up at my school in the last few months. And it's amazing when you look into it and see there's a lot of information out there. So there's never a lot of data. And as actuaries, we like lots of data and we like full data, but we're never going to have enough. And you need to often make decisions earlier along the line. Okay, so let's have a look at this case study. I'll let you soak up that graph. On the left-hand side, this is just Victoria, right? So this is where I live. Victoria was the first jurisdiction in the world to introduce seatbelts, and it did that way back in 1970. Now, I was in Ireland at the time. I didn't come to Australia till 1985. In Ireland, they introduced it in 1979, which was 9 years later. And I remember the angst and the indignation that the government could restrict our freedom by causing us to put this belt on. It was really interesting. How on earth could you drive with a belt on you? But look at what happened in those 30 years from 1970 to 2000 in Victoria. And it obviously wasn't all just the seat belts, but over that period of time, through a number of different initiatives, the number of deaths on the road came from just under 1,100, down to 400. Now, that's a phenomenal reduction. And at the same time, the number of cars on the road and the number of kilometres driven all increased. So if you look at a per kilometre driven, etc., you get an even greater decrease. What I'm getting at here is that society can change, and behavior can change, and when behavior changes, the culture changes. So culture really is the end product of behavior. So even across societies, that can be done. In a case like this, you could see there was a lot of effort went into it. There were lots of innovative campaigns around different things. Random breath testing was a big one. Another memory I have, when I came to Australia in 85. Now, we came in November to Australian Eagle Life Insurance, as I mentioned earlier, and I came just in time for the Christmas party. And the Christmas party was being held at Luna Park, so the same sort of place as you have in Sydney. And there was a big park area beside it, and they had marquees set up there for food and drink. And I saw these booze buses. And the lights were on, and it was very clear that they were there. And again, it was a bit of a shock to see this, but it was really satisfying to see that Victoria was taking the health of its people really seriously. And what I found quite interesting was the attitude of my colleagues. Anyone who had had a drink had several drinks had prearranged to get a taxi home. And I think the company gave out taxi vouchers to do that, cab charges or whatever they were at the time. And that was acceptable. That was the norm. So these things can change with time. So this is then the next sort of 8 years after that. And you can see it jagged around a bit, where we're now down around 400, 460. But we're getting down towards the 300 after 8 years. And multiple initiatives going on all the time. The two on the right-hand side, I'm not sure if you can see them very clearly, but these here, implementation of graduated licensing system, and these are all P-plate rules in effect. Some of this will be reasonably familiar to you. I'm sure New South Wales has some sort of similar program. But this has been fantastic for me. I've got four children, and the eldest is 22. I taught her to drive, but she had this regime imposed on her. she had to do 120 hours while she was doing her L plates. So by the time she got to that, she knew how to drive and she really understood things. So all of this is actually decreasing the number of deaths on the road. And she couldn't go out with a bunch of her mates on a Saturday night all in the car while she was on her L's, even if some of the others had licenses, you know, restrictions on numbers in the car to avoid that behavior that you can sometimes get when you get a lot of excited people together and concentration dips and an accident happens. So it's really worked. Since then, we're up to, so this is the last one, year's 2011. So this is a 2011 plan by the TAC. And you're getting down to just under 300. Sorry, just 288 they had there the last time. In 2014, there were 249 deaths in Victoria. And 2013, it was actually less. It was 243. So it really worked. Now, this campaign in 2011 was targeting a 30% reduction to 237 deaths, right? That's what they were looking at. Okay, so again, another campaign. But the icing on the cake is the latest plan, towards zero. Now, what a change in attitudes that is over 40 years. And it shows that culture can be changed. It requires leadership, it requires courage, it requires innovation, but it can be done. Anybody got any comments on that? I want to ask questions or discuss. I've spent a fair bit of time on that because I think it's a great example of, you know, risk culture. That's, you know, risk to human life is the most important. Important risks to avoid or to mitigate altogether. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh, I think. You know, an organization like the TAC, it collects whatever statistics it can, and it does a lot of it, and there's a bunch of actuaries in there too. And they analyze the information they have, and then the data tells them what to expect. Most people will go around the world and search other jurisdictions. So that's probably the easiest way to do anything better these days is to look around for best practice. I saw a graph the other day on the number of road deaths, you know, per 100,000 population across you know, all countries. It was a UN type publication, and Australia, I think within the OECD, Australia overall is just about the middle of the pack. It's a bit less than the middle of the pack. Sort of developed nations. Then if you look at some other places like South Africa, for instance, it's, I think Australia might be 8 per 100,000 population or something like that, and or per 100 million, or sorry, per million or something. Well, 100,000, maybe 100,000, about right. But it's 8, and then South Africa's 40 or something. You know, there's a million people killed on the roads every year. It's that worldwide. It's that sort of figure. And in places like I think Iceland has the lowest rate, and the Scandinavian countries are pretty good. I mean, it depends on some variation in circumstances. But what people do is they look around the world and see, well, who's got the lowest? What are they doing that we're not doing? And building on that there. So that's relatively simple, isn't it? There's a way of doing things. I suppose that's about being open to ideas as to what might work. Okay, so let me roll on. How are you in time? Okay, I'm probably talking too much. Risk and risk management. So we'll come now really to the nitty-gritty, define some things, perhaps a more actuarial approach. Risk management and risk and managing risk and being a risk manager are very different to different people. So different people interpret it in different ways. But I wouldn't worry about trying to be too precise. This definition is one I love. It's very basic. It's the effect of uncertainty on objectives. It's ISO 31000. That's the leading standard for a risk management framework throughout the world. Australian developed, in fact. And that's used right across companies, be they financial services companies or miners or hospitals, right across the board. So risk management then, this is the ASX Corporate Governance Council definition of it. And I like this one because it talks about opportunities as well as risk. So it's two-sided. Okay, what do we mean by enterprise risk management? So the board will usually and should set an organization's risk appetite. And the risk appetite is just how much risk an organization is prepared to take on. But it's always best to know that in advance, which is why you should have a risk appetite statement rather than it happen. You take on a big risk and you say, oh, should I have taken that on or not? Oh, I didn't work it out beforehand. So risk appetite is at the basis. And then every director on the board needs to understand that risk and that risk level, and it needs to be shared with the organization down through the executive management and ultimately to those who are at the coalface in whatever business it is. And different elements can be defined and limits and thresholds set for particular tasks or particular risks as you go down through an organization. And enterprise risk management simply considers all of the potential risks and the opportunities across the organization. Sometimes it's called ERM. It's integrated, as the AICD says, the Australian Institute of Company Directors. It's an integrated approach to looking at risks. You're looking at the multitude of risks and their interaction as well. So a good example of the value of an ERM mindset is the high importance rating agencies place on risk management when they're assessing the credit rating of an organization. And James Lamb, who's the person who first coined the term chief risk officer, states that risk management is firstly about balancing risk and reward, and that the challenge for leaders is to take intelligent risks. And he actually wrote one of the books for the actuarial course on risk management, ST9, the one out of the UK that we all do here, if you're interested in that line. And he was the first chief risk officer, but he was in banking. So it wasn't life insurance, it was banking. Now, the reality is that the downside of risk is what most people think of, firstly, including boards and directors. And it's quite a bit of self-education or helped education to actually turn it around the other way and look at the opportunities as well and the strategic elements of that, because you need to be aware of the opportunities. So moving on to risk culture, again, multiple definitions. This is the one that Andrew and I like. It describes the degree to which its culture, an organization's culture, encourages or limits the taking of risk and the opportunity that arises from those risks. It's about people's individual and collective behaviours. For many years, and since the GFC in particular, regulators around the world have been working hard to increase the awareness of risk culture among organisations, and APRA is right at the forefront of this. It's been very vocal in that. It actually includes in CPS 220, which is the Prudential Standard on Risk Management, same one that applies across life insurance, general insurance, and banking. It actually says in that the board must ensure, and I quote, that it forms a view of the risk culture in the institution and the extent to which that culture supports the ability of the institution to operate consistently within its risk appetite, identifies any desirable changes to the risk culture, and ensures the institution takes steps to address those changes. And this quote here is from John Laker, former chairman of APRA, where he says, and you can read it as well as I can, but essentially it's critical to have a strong risk culture. And the piece that I really like is that he talks about behaviors. You know, it's behaviors. It's not structures. It's not having a framework and all of that. You need all that. But at the end of the day, it's about behaviors. So let's go a bit more into culture itself. And Ed Schein is probably the leading organizational culture expert in the world. He does a lot of work for companies of all sorts and sizes. The definition that we've used is based on his work, so it's around the behavior elements. And he identified three elements of culture in an organization. So the first is artifacts. Now, the artifacts are the characteristics of the organization which can be easily viewed, heard, and felt by individuals. And that might include, you know, any element from the board member right down to the person at the front desk who is the front line for the company. And it covers things like the formality of the organization. So what can you see? Dress code, room layouts, furniture, all those elements influence the culture of an organization. I suppose most importantly, it's the manner that the board members and the executive team actually live the mission and values. That's what really matters of their organization, and how they actively enforce their values and their vision for the company through the rest of the organization, through whatever policies and procedures that they have in place. So artifacts is the first element. Espoused values is the second. What the organization stands for. What are its values? And that must come from the top and then be lived through the rest of the organization. The officially stated values may be different to those observed and those that are implicitly communicated across the organization by the earlier artifacts. It includes vision, mission, value statements, and strategic plans. And we've all seen them, and for most organizations, they're pretty much the same. It's trust, integrity, customer focus, etc. I remember an actuary who had moved from a life company to a bank. He'd moved from the AMP to the NAB many years ago, and he gave an insight session. And, he actually lifted up the two vision statements of the organizations, and you couldn't really tell the difference. Yeah, they were all about being the best financial services company and doing the right thing by people, etc. And there are absolutely laudable aims, and that's absolutely appropriate. But interesting, you know, there's a bank and a life insurance company, and they have the same aspirations, the same values. But are they lived out the same way within the company, or within places within the company? Maybe not. So the third element of culture is tacit assumptions. And this is really the most important one. The underlying or unconscious assumptions across an organization, which is really what one feels about the way we do things around here. You know, if you think about the organization you work for, what does it feel like? You know, how are things done around here? You know, are people nice to you, or are they, you know, dictatorial, or, you know, are you out the door if you don't get certain things done by certain times, or are they understanding if you get sick, or, you know, there's all these things, and we all feel that, and we all know that, and it's not what's written on the piece of paper that matters, and it's that underlying culture that are from those tacit assumptions that's most important. And when we want to improve a culture and have a mature risk culture, it's really about influencing people and moving them along towards that. And that understanding of the human condition, I suppose, is critical to that. So the tacit assumptions about the board and the organization will be formed through the myths and stories about the board and about the executive, and you know, what are they really like behind the scenes when the facade comes off, and maybe they're the same people. You know, the right people would be the same people and genuine. In particular, though, it's the actual behaviors that people observe that matters. That's what people pick up on, you know. As Ralph Emerson once wrote, "Your actions speak so loudly that I cannot hear what you are saying." Yeah. Actions are louder than words. People know. People see through the things. It might take a little while, but they do eventually see through. So how the board then interacts with the people in the organization depends on its behavior, their behavior, and the behavior of their managers through the organization. What we really do versus what we say we do, and then we've got this say-do gap in the middle. So obviously you want that to be as narrow as possible if you're to be truly being what you want to be as an organization. Truer to your values. So that's the culture setting. Now, if we move to a mature risk culture, what do we mean by that? So culture is quite pervasive, you know. It's right across things. It influences the way everything is done. Now, Shine says we tend to think we can separate strategy from culture, but we fail to notice that in most organizations, strategic thinking is deeply colored by the tacit assumptions we've just seen. The tacit assumptions about who they are and what their mission is. And because it's tacit and sometimes it's implicit rather than real, it has more of an influence perhaps than people realize. So you've got to be aware of that. What this implies for a mature risk culture in a board, for instance, is that risk will be part and parcel of every conversation that happens, every decision that's made. Yep. Ah. There we go. Thank you. Yeah, it'll be part of decision making, part of strategic thinking. We'll be there. When the board observes and interacts with the CEO and senior management, directors are considering and should be considering how the risk appetite that they're promulgating is actually coming through. Now, in a mature risk culture, processes and board mindset drive the management of immediate risk, drives the understanding of new and emerging risk, and an ongoing exploration that increases the resilience and adaptive capability of the organization to future unknown risks. Because there's always those three phases. So what are the observable stages of risk maturity? So we're going on a scale from being totally risk unaware to being reactive or compliant. Now, compliance is something that we all have too much to do, we would say, in our jobs. Lots of forms to fill, and you know, you're only doing what you're told to do. Well, that's not very creative. It's not very businesslike necessarily. At the same time, it is the minimum level of risk management that you need to have. You've got to stick to the rules. You're in a legal setting. You're in a regulatory setting. You've got to play by the rules. You just hope that the regulator doesn't keep introducing more and more rules all the time. There's no recognition of opportunity in here, so that's a bit limited. And there's no link to strategy or decisions. So you don't want to spend too much time on that. So the next stage really is mechanical. So this is a historical or traditional form of leadership that we've had. And it's all around organizing the means of work. So Henry Ford, when he had his production line, It was all very, very focused, set up. But his vision to have a simple, inexpensive vehicle, came to fruition. And he broke new ground with this type of approach at the time. So he was thinking ahead. And it was really only his extraordinary leadership that pushed that through. And you get a lot of that in entrepreneurs. They're right and everybody else is wrong, and that can be good for the economy at times. and other times it's not. We might get a sample of that with Malcolm Turnbull over the next couple of years. We shall wait and see. He once said that if he had given his clients what they asked for, he would have been making higher quality buggies and whips. for horse-driven buggies. But the assembly line that he did create, magnificent as well, also had significant downsides in terms of quality circles. Engagement. There's a lack of engagement that comes if you're doing something mechanical all the time, repetitive, etc. You can make the car door, but if you don't see the full product, it's a bit limiting. And you can't get that sense of ownership. So as we move across to the right of the risk culture line to mature, the more engagement you can have, the better it is. You've got to be proactive. So this is taking responsibility. Okay, so far we didn't have any taking of responsibility. Especially when it's not pretty, but you've got to do it. Now you're thinking, and now you're being responsible, you're being accountable, and that can only help. So finally you end up in a mature position where the culture encourages teamwork, encourages distributed responsibility. The team is better than the individual. If you work well and integrate properly. So you're sharing insights and you're learning from others all the time. You've got a greater diversity of thought. You're going to think of more opportunities. You're going to think of more ways that you constructively deal with the risks that are emerging. And on the opportunity side, you can be successful and make money from them. And in something like insurance, obviously, insurance is different to every other company as far as risk is concerned, or most other companies, because risk is what gives you your livelihood. That's what it's all about. So there's the full grid. Across the top of that grid, we've got unaware, reactive, mechanical, proactive, mature. And down the side, you've got different mindsets. Okay, so there's a For a truly mature circumstance, you want to be integrating all of those elements. Your individual mindset, you've got the group mindset, different behavior, there's different systems, there might be tools that you're using, etc. And then there's the risk function itself in a financial services company, which is actually overseeing the implementation of the risk framework and what controls are there in place and keeping an eye on it. Excuse me. So how do you shape a culture? So our friend Ed Schein again. If you set out to change the culture directly, you end up in fog. If you set out to change behavior, then you'll change the culture. Schein's top seven influences. Oh, sorry. I keep forgetting to go in there. There you go, there's that nice picture with the quote. There's no fog there. That wasn't like Melbourne this morning, I can assure you. Okay, what shapes culture? Schein's top seven influences on culture in descending order were what you see there on the screen. The main factor is what the leader attends to, what they reward, what's their direct interaction with that. Because that tells you most. You can see it. You can observe it. The second one is how they react to critical incidents. Do they shoot the messenger? Or do they actually take a positive response to it. Leader role modeling is just, you know, being a leader and mentoring people, for instance, is quite useful in that regard. You've got to get these things right from the start. So you need, when you're doing your recruitment, that's your best opportunity to pick the right people. And that doesn't mean the same sort of person as you, because that's not a good idea. That defeats the diversity side. But you want people with the same values as your company. And I'm sure each of the companies you work for is quite strong on values. And they are because it really matters. And sometimes, you know, we take it with a grain of salt, perhaps. But it is really important. If we're to work together, you want to be able to trust the people you work with. You want to be able to be honest with your discussions. You know, you want to be able to volunteer things and and know you're not going to be shot down, and other people won't think less of you for that matter. Now, the top four of these are all leadership elements. So to get the right culture in an organization, leadership is incredibly important. I mentioned earlier tone from the top. We often also say tune in the middle. You know, it's no good if it's just the top that's sprouting these things and it's not coming down through the organization. It has to be throughout the organization. But if it's not at the top, it's not going to come down. So the key driver really is culture. Is leadership to get the right culture. I have a few case studies here. I'll just mention again the papers at the very end of the slide deck, and these slides will be up on the Institute website afterwards, so you can download them. The second or third last page just lists the two papers that Andrew and I wrote. So one was for the summit 2 and a half years ago, and that was on leadership, board leadership in complexity, etc. And I think these case studies, you'll find a bit more detail on them, and the ones I'm not going to talk about now, you'll find in those documents. And the second paper is the one we did for last year's Financial Services Forum. And that was on measuring culture change. So we'll cover some of that as we go on, but the full details, and there's more details in those papers if you're interested. Okay, so global financial crisis is the first one I'll talk about. We all learn best from experiential learning. So going through the pain of a learning means that you have it for life. You know, if you burn your finger on the stove when you're young, you know, you remember that. It's better not to do that. It's better to have the mitigation in place, like your mum keeping you away from it. But some of us do get around to touching it. Learning by experience is the best way. What we want to do with these case studies is learn from someone else's experience and not get burnt. Now, the GFC, for some US businesses, was actually a good example of where risk management, having good risk management in place, actually worked and meant things were not as bad as they otherwise would have been. The Ivy Business School in 2010, which was just after the GFC, or the Great Recession, as they call it over there, in the States, ran a series of candid discussions with about 300 C-suite people. And they found that good leadership certainly did make a difference, especially with regard to risk management. The people understood the potential impact and wider implication of these problems and actually took immediate action to circumvent them. And the quote was, or there's a couple of quotes here. One is, essentially these organizations had cultures attuned to potential risks, with the ability to manage the dynamics effectively. And a number of comments from that assessment highlight the strong influence of a positive risk culture. And they said it's the leader's responsibility to manage risk effectively. Business leaders achieve effective risk management by doing three simple things well. They ask the right questions. They consult with a mix of people with different perspectives, backgrounds, and knowledge. And the most effective leaders during the global financial meltdown were people who had integrity, courage, and compassion. They were careful, prudent, and aware of their limitations. Now, all of those elements are the sort of values that most companies espouse for themselves. You've got to actually have them in your heart, and you've got to encourage them in your people. And if you do, you will get the right reaction in times of crisis. And a lot of that is around resilience. Probably the most important thing that companies can do in averting risks coming to pass, hazards, events happening, is that the people in the organization are resilient. So if something hits, they don't get completely knocked out. They can pick up the pieces, and they've got an open enough culture to actually fix things up and move forward and not be overwhelmed by it. Now, another good example is APRA. Its risk culture really matured from the early 2000s to when the GFC happened. And we've got HIH to thank for that. In the years between the problems at HIH and 2007-08, when the GFC hit, its leadership drove change in the organization's culture within APRA and in its external interactions. It raised internal expectations, firstly, of the level of professional performance that was required, and it also raised expectations around the level of enterprise risk management that was required. As APRA member Charles Littrell said in 2011, there is no good prudential regulation without good supervision. And there is no good supervision without a culture of effective intervention. So they didn't only just say things, they did things. And you know, the country has them to thank in that respect, and maybe thank HIH as well for putting them on the right path. But you look at the States and what happened there, and organizations in the supervisory area, not talking to each other and not realizing that there's a crack in the floorboards where some of the risks weren't being supervised, and also the manner of supervision was nothing like we had here. So it walked the walk, as well as taking the pain before that. What's really important for that is that they learned from the experience, and that's what you want every organization to do, and the people in organizations to do, is to learn. So that was the good, the bad, and the ugly, the other side of the case studies. So that's Mr. Bearings there in the Time cover on the front, Ego and Greed, Collapse of Bearings, was one of the lesser limelights the last 15 years or so. So like at the movies, the bad and the ugly characters are more etched in our memories than the good. HIH is now a classic textbook case study of poor organizational culture from the top. Poor governance and management, including underpricing and under-reserving for future claims over many years, led to the 2001 collapse, $5.3 billion back then. That's a lot of money. What led to this? There was a big inquiry, it was a Royal Commission, and Justice Owen reported in 2003 on that. Some of this stuff, again, it's really well worth reading through the original description of what he said, and there are pages and pages of it. I don't know whether, did any of you do it at uni as a case study? Yeah? Yeah, you probably all did. Oh, this is all boring then. Well, I'll read out that sentence, my favorite sentence from this, because it just captures everything. So mismanagement is a failure of culture. Quote, the problematic aspects of the corporate culture of HIH, which led directly to the poor decision-making, can be summarized succinctly. There was blind faith in a leadership that was ill-equipped for the task. There was insufficient ability and independence of mind in and associated with the organization to see what had to be done and what had to be stopped or avoided. Risks were not properly identified and managed. It's pretty blunt. Unpleasant information was hidden, filtered, or sanitized. And there was a lack of skeptical questioning and analysis when and where it mattered. That's all you need to learn, really. It's just that paragraph and you're right for life from a risk management perspective. Okay, so moving on, back in 1915, or moving back, I suppose, Winston Churchill said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Unfortunately, when it comes to risk management, people don't learn from history. It's terrible. We're poor learners. The series of losses arising from lack of control and supervision of financial traders stands testimony to this failure of leadership and management. Bearings in 1995, a loss of £0.8 billion. Societe Generale 2008, €4.9 billion. UBS 2011, €2 billion. Our own NAB in 2004 on foreign exchange, £0.4 billion. That's small, that's okay. £0.4 billion. Kimberly Krywak, in her 2009 paper, The Return of the Rogue, makes the link to risk culture when she says, more broadly, the debilitating losses at many financial institutions have been blamed to a large extent on a lack of internal controls and oversight, combined with an industry culture that sacrificed prudent risk management in the pursuit of superior profits. The money's at the root of all evil, is the translation. But the culture was wrong. The culture was wrong in each of these individual circumstances. And sometimes that was just close to the individual. So in the NAB case, it was around that group of people in foreign exchange. But, you know, why aren't those things recognized? And there have been other examples since as well. So part of the mature risk culture that board leaders need to develop and instill in their organizations is a willingness to learn from their own mistakes, particularly, and from the mistakes of others. Okay, how am I going? I'll give another few minutes, and that'll be about an hour or so. Okay, obstacles to a mature risk culture. I don't know whether any of you enjoy Dilbert, the cartoonist that has the office situations. Oh, I think he's fantastic. I had to put a quote in here on him. I get his calendar every year, and first thing in the morning, I find something that's too close to the bone in a corporate organization. Corporates have yes, amazing cultures. Most success springs from an obstacle or failure. I became a cartoonist largely because I failed in my goal of becoming a successful executive. Well, I think that's his excuse, but they're all good learning, so we need to learn from them. So what are the obstacles to a mature risk culture? Death by regulation is undue emphasis on compliance and the non-material risks. And these take a lot of time, and they can distract the business from what the business should be concentrating on, because it's hiding the major issues. So you don't see them clearly. And in the board case, if they're too much on compliance, they're not looking at their strategic opportunities and they're not bringing the business forward. So the trick is, be aware of that. And yes, you've got to meet a certain amount. You've got to play by the rules, but you've got to be careful to balance things. Drinking the Kool-Aid. This is the danger of everybody going along with the popular stories. You know, groupthink, acting as a herd. You know, you've got to think independently. And sometimes diversity will always help that to a greater extent, whether it's gender, whether it's background, whether it's different life experience, whether it's different professions, you know. You get 10 actuaries in a room, you know, are you going to have a better outcome if you get 5 actuaries and 5 engineers, or 5 actuaries and 5 marketing people? Yeah, I'm sure you would, because you get a diversity of opinion, you've got different ways of thinking, you bring all that to the table. You need voices of dissension, right? If everybody thinks the same way, that you come to a crisis, and everybody's going to think the same way, and people will be afraid to say something alternative, which is not good. You want an organization to be able to bounce back when it's under stress and do different things. Rubber bands. Behaviors do revert under stress. Now, people's behavior under stress is quite different to what it is normally, and it can be very different to what you expect. Even yourself, you might think, okay, I've learned all this stuff. If there's an emergency, I'll do this or I'll do that. But when the emergency comes, it's like when the alarm goes off. You know, you think, oh, should I go or should I stay? It's just another nuisance alarm or something like that. But I remember hearing with the World Trade Centers, there was one of the organizations there. And they had a person who had drilled into people, and he was an ex-army person, and he was there, and he had trained the people to run down that stairs immediately, and he practiced it. And I don't know whether he was lower down, whether it was the 50th or 60th or something like that, but he got all his people out that day, because it was in their head, they were drilled into it, and they just went for it. So that preparation was invaluable. And under stress, in that particular instance, they'd been so trained to do this thing, they did it. And they didn't start thinking about other things or lose their cool or panic or the like. So you don't realize you're reverting as well. That's the other thing, which can be quite dangerous. So being self-aware is probably one of the most important things you can be in any risk situation. Know your limitations, know your strengths, and play to them. Sterility. Seeing your team only showing things that are perfect. If you're filtering information at any point in the organization, well, whoever you're filtering it to is not going to get the full story, and then there's going to be a shock at some point. There'll be an explosion. Yeah, the CEO, if CEO is too polished, well then, you know, the board's only hearing a certain amount, and it's the same down through the organization. Okay, sorry, that was us. I'm missing that. Second group, great dictator, you know, the charismatic leader. But if that person is aggressive and pushes down people or doesn't take opinion from them or doesn't take advice from people, then it's going to go, the company's going to go in a certain direction. And that can be okay for a while to make change, perhaps. But if it keeps going, the rest of the organization will either leave or get pushed out, or it'll be following a narrow path. So it's very, very dangerous. Starving child relates to insufficient resources. You need resources to manage risk and to have the right culture in an organization. Modelomania, so confusion of models with reality. You know, this is a great one for actuaries, if you over rely on models or the communication around them. Don't. Understand them, communicate them, but communicate the limitations as well. Because it's only through communicating the limitations that people get the wider understanding of risk and what might happen or the extent to which things might happen. Night blindness, so lots of navigation for known risk. So, you know, I've got it all, I've got my list of risks, that's what I'm going to deal with, that's what I know about, and then you get hit from left field by something else. And it's the hit from left field that's likely to knock out your organization or bankrupt it or whatever. So it's really important to be aware of those things, keep looking for them. You know, what risks are emerging? What are the dangers to your organization? You know, so these days, you know, we all now know about digital disruption in various ways. It keeps changing form, etc. But if you go back 5 years or so. And if you were tuned into technology and the power of the internet, you would have seen some of those things coming. And so your cab businesses or your accommodation businesses, might be a bit in a different situation if you were innovative and introduced those things yourself rather than someone else. Okay. Measuring. Yep.
Just with the obstacles you were going in.
Yeah.
How do you put organizational politics under that framework?
Yeah.
Because particularly for bigger businesses, you do really have an ebb and flow in terms of how decisions are made, and the final decision can be quite a sizable departure from its original intent.
Yeah, it's hard. I think what you have to try and do is to reduce the number of layers. So the less layers you have, then the less opportunities for change and restriction or filtering, etc., up along the line. Have communication at all levels too. Not have people in their ivory towers. Open plan offices obviously help with that to some degree. Things like an active program around values and recognition is helpful, because it just reinforces that the values that the organization states are actually appreciated and are genuine. Having discussions or town hall type meetings where you actually have some dialogue helps as well. At the end of the day, they're hierarchical organizations and people make decisions. But if you have a sense of cooperation, that does feed into the culture. But it's not easy. It's not easy. Yeah. And that's what you try and measure through this piece. Now, I'm going to skip this piece because we've got an hour. So I wasn't sure how long this would all take. But enjoy it on the slideshow. And if you want to go to the paper, you'll find more. So this is all about measurement, different ways you can measure culture. And you've got to be able to measure something to be able to work out how you're going to change it the way you want to change it. That's the key thing. A lot of people throw up their hands at measuring culture. How do you measure it? But there are ways and means. The main ones are the basis of the survey, and you probably all do an engagement survey or something like that. The trick there is to look at the trends over time, but don't just rely on the survey. You need a lot of other information as well. Several items listed there. Okay. So, two insights. Okay, I'm just going to skip through that. Here we go. Conclusion. Okay, so this basically is picking out some of the main points through the discussion. You want to optimize return versus risk, and you want to do that from a risk culture perspective, given that's our setting. Risk is integral to every decision. The board sets the tone. We talk about tone from the top, tune from the middle, how the organization thinks, how it breathes. Number three, invest in mature leadership. These things are not always obvious. It's only when you study them and look at those case studies or go through either case studies or actually go through processes like workshops, etc. So, one of the great ways an organization can understand risk is to have a workshop with stress scenarios, so you might come from APRA. I think there's one on at the moment that APRA has asked life insurance companies to do there's 8 life insurance companies, and what are you going to do as a company if the equity markets fall 50%, if house prices fall 50%, and if unemployment goes up to 14% from the 6 it is now, what are you going to do? If you put people in a room and give them an hour and a half with that, they're going to learn. They're going to learn a lot more than if you just give them the sheet of paper and come back 2 months later and do a report. It's investing in that sort of training is a good example of how you actually prepare people for the ultimate challenge when it comes along. A diverse team, talked about that. Catastrophe requires resilience, so the more practice you have at being shocked, I suppose, and at doing things differently, the more likely you are to act properly and best for your company in the event of a crisis. Corporate governance is really important. You need a framework. It's like checklists. You don't want to have to be thinking about things at a particular time. You want all the elements around risk management to be covered and to know that they're covered, so there aren't the cracks in various places. So corporate governance is really important. And transparency enhances your brand anyway, both with your customers and internally. You know, can you trust this person? Can you trust this company? And being open is always best. Have your organization humming. That's really about... When things go bad, you want to be able to concentrate on that badness. Now, if your systems are falling apart and you're having crises with your people, a big turnover rate, etc., if that's the point at which the GFC hits, how are you going to cope? You know, it's going to be really hard compared to the organization that has its governance in place and is going along pretty well. It's working hard. Every company works hard, but things are humming along. That's your best defense in preparation for something going wrong, so that then your resources, your people, can be targeted on the issue at hand, the crisis. Okay, so there's a bunch of recommendations. The main one really is taking the time to think, and this information here is more geared at executives and directors in companies than you. You haven't got to that stage yet. Someday you'll be there, but not yet. And it's really about taking the time to think about how all those conclusions we talked about earlier are actually implemented through. One of the things I liked here was in number four, get external independent objectives. Objective assessments. So there was a company I knew that used to use one of the consultants I worked with, a senior person in the industry, just to come in for a chat every quarter, you know, with the chair of the board. Because that external consultant was able to just bring a different perspective on the industry and what the issues might be. Okay, there we go. And finally, takeaways. So that's on measuring risk culture. Measuring it does help you to navigate the course. So remember, you're all the time trying to get to this mature risk culture where there is harmony, there's diversity, the talents that the organization has are being used effectively all the time. And if you're in that position, then you'll be dealing with risk and with opportunity very well. And the more mature you are, the better you're placed to deal with anything that comes up, including avoiding risk and mitigating risk. And coming back to APRA, APRA is very strong in having a sound risk culture in your organization. And some people think they harp on a bit too much about it. But it's really at the core of any organization. And I, for one, totally understand where they're coming from. And I also think it's a big battle to get that across to people who haven't thought about it a lot before. And the bigger organizations do, you know, but there's a lot of smaller super funds, for instance, out there who've come from a different history, grown rapidly over time, and they're not used to thinking that way. but it's better for them and their organizations that they do and put these things in place. Okay, three key areas to measure and manage are ownership of the risk. So who's owning the risk? And you've got to have ownership. That's accountability, responsibility. The social coherence in the organization for best performance. You want that. And really looking forward, adapting to change is critical. You know, you've got to be innovative. And being innovative, you know, often means just doing lots of little things well, but constantly looking to improve as you go forward. This quote here, I think, is good because it talks about, you start on a journey and you go through everything and then you find you're back where you started. But you know a lot more. So hopefully tonight is taking you on that journey and that you've learned something. Here we go. That's it. There are the papers. Happy to take questions. And there's Andrew and me. any questions? I'll bore you to tears. on any of that.
I suppose just one last one would be... Yeah. I sort of struggle with, particularly when I'm dealing with people directly involved in implementing these controls and everything else, is trying to take a step back from full speed in these abstract concepts into reality and being a bit more pragmatic about which controls you do prioritise and how you try and sell this message to different stakeholders within the business.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, in your experience, do you have any cases where you've just taken a step back and looked at a particular instance and tried to highlight, okay, realistically speaking, for this business, there's only one or two things we really want to harp and ingrain on? Just curious.
Yeah, it's good if you can do that. I think one example of that I'd give is in the school where I chair the risk management committee, and the easy risk to deal with, to discuss and to put controls around is the financial risk, because you can have an audit and you can say specifically whoever's preparing the request for the check should not be the person who signs it. You know, that separation of duties thing. So you get independence in that. But one of the things we actually discussed with the leadership group was the fact that the controls you have around finances are fine. You don't need to. You just keep doing the things you're doing. Don't worry. In fact, it came back on an auditor's report. I think that's probably how it arose. There wasn't enough separation of duties in their line because they were looking for a separate person doing preparation versus signing off. And because it was only... because it's a school and it employs 67 teachers and 33 others, by the time you get to the accounts department, there's two people, you know, one of which is a senior. So you just didn't have the numbers, and it would be a waste of money to actually get to have another person. So the risk, the cost benefit there was that, okay, don't bother. That's fine. Yeah. So that's, you know, slightly. Different way of looking at it, but it was the same principle. I think you've got to be very pragmatic, and be. It's more important that the important things get done than everything gets done badly. It's prioritization, and it's assessing what is the biggest bang for your buck, really, more than anything else. And you have to. You have to comply with the law, but if there's elements of interpretation, you go by your judgment. You know, and be pragmatic. The worst possible thing is to get someone to do a procedure that they can see is not adding value, because it just turns them off completely, and you're destroying their initiative and their motivation and everything like that. And you're best to call that in effect. So if you want to change the rules, then change them to something more sensible. And a lot of that comes back to resourcing. You've only got a certain number of dollars to implement things. What do you do with that? What's the best thing to do with it? And another way that I look on those elements around risk is, it's much more important to have the right person in the place than the right procedures and controls. Because the person, if they've got the right atmosphere, the right encouragement, the right support, will figure out what the right thing to do is, you know, when something goes wrong. And that's the best mitigation of all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose the upper management should be the ones that are telling you rather than the other way around. I suppose it's more in the totality of things. I suppose the first thing is, you know, always minimize whatever framework you're putting in terms of the nuts and bolts of it. Get the core, have the core, and be rigorous in keeping it to the important stuff. That's the most important thing. Don't put in bells and whistles. Just put in the basics and build over time. So get something basic in, so it doesn't take too much time. And I think then how you sell it. If you can find some examples of where something went wrong. Obviously, there's case studies like this where things go wrong all the time. find one that's as close as possible to their situation. Or if you can think, and sometimes the process that you're going through, often the process you're going through in identifying and assessing the risks that are there, will come up with, oh, there's a risk that such and such a thing will happen. You know, your system may fail in the middle of your valuation run if I don't put this control in to make sure that Jenny checks that all the input parameters have been correct or something like that, you know. And finding examples is a great way to do that, relevant to their business. So if you can think what's on their KPI and then what can go wrong with an element in there, is your best bet. Yeah. Yeah. Remuneration seems to matter a lot. It's human nature, but it does drive a lot of decisions, and it's driven some very wrong decisions in the past for those traders and the like. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah? Sure.